This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design programme. I'm your host, Tom Edwards, standing in for Josh Fennett this week. On today's programme...
So the design was underestimated and was absolutely not interesting, so no one was looking into this history of Soviet design.
The director of Moscow's Design Museum discusses her favourite overlooked Soviet designs, including a vacuum cleaner that doubles as a ceiling roller. And...
Andre tells me many Brazilian financial types come by the shop that's open for anyone to visit 5 days a week. Such interest, he explains, shows just how valuable Brazilian design has become as a collectible commodity.
We head to the Sao Paulo shop selling Brazilian modernist furniture that's making waves across the Atlantic. Plus, the London Design Biennale is underway. Here's what you shouldn't miss. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. But first, when it comes to fashion, perceptions of brand made in China have been troubled to say the least. But a new crop of homegrown talent clustered in the Chinese city of Xiamen is proving there's a lot more to Chinese designers than fast fashion and high street retail. Monocle's Kurt Lin reports.
Beijing and Shanghai are hardly going out of style when it comes to their fashion offerings, but another Chinese city is quickly climbing the ranks to cement itself as a fashion hub of a different kind, a hub for the designers themselves. Located in the heart of coastal Fujian province, the city of Xiamen retains a long history of textile manufacturing and merchandising under its belt, and is considered to be one of the most livable cities in the country. Culturally similar to Taiwan and known for its year-round balmy climes, the city has become a solid base for designers who want to escape the big city lifestyle of nearby Shanghai and Hong Kong, giving entrepreneurs more time to focus on the creative process and, more importantly, proving that the label made in China doesn't mean low-quality design.
I think made in China always got a bad rap from a Western perspective about making cheap product. So that drove Western attitudes towards made-in-China product.
There's Ian Hilton, who relocated to China from New York in 2005 and is president of the women's wear label Miss Min, which is known for its shinrasuri style. The brand, founded by his partner Min Liu, is part of the Xiamen Gang, a circle of successful Chinese designer nicknamed as a tribute to Europe's Antwerp Six.
What I learned when I moved to China in 2005 is that actually most of the factories that I started working with had two production lines. They had a production line for the West, which is basically you want cheap shit, here you go. And they had production line for Chinese consumption, which was not the same production line, because the Chinese wouldn't wear the crap that was being exported. That's the truth. So made in China, you know, I always get almost kind of like mad about it, because it's like you wanted cheap shit, you got cheap shit, so and then you wanted to call China cheap. China's not cheap. China has got a history of luxury that's dynasties old. Luxury originated here. It's not something that's new to China. Let's start this way. When we first started in the U.S., for instance, I remember our agent Christopher Demison, one of the first things he said to me when we met in our first meeting in New York, he said to me, you know that made in China is going to be a challenge. He said he had seen all our pictures and he'd seen the profile and he saw what we were doing, and he said, you know, when we tell the customers made in China, it's going to be a challenge. When he saw the first collection, he said, oh, I take back everything I said. This is nobody's even going to ask where this is made. It's so beautiful, it could be made anywhere. So it's not about made in China, and I feel that those attitudes as more beautiful things, more artisans in fashion and furniture, and well, technology is obviously taken a forefront in contemporary art, it will take its right place back in the world of luxury.
One of the success stories is Vega Wang, who founded her eponymous brand in Beijing in 2009 and moved to Xiamen about 3 years ago. Her women's wear label, famous for winter overcoats, has won many hearts in the northern part of China. I asked what she thinks about the changing perception of Chinese design.
It's
going through progressive change.
boundless change. And every year, foreign professionals and students come. I really think it's a period of change. Personally, because I started out in 2009, which is pretty early, a lot of people have asked me this question about what the Chinese elements are. I've got a new perspective on this question. In comparison, China developed quite late. However, it has 5,000 years of history as a country and as a culture. It's hard to represent the country and the culture by a few symbols like the color red or dragons. We don't really have the agency to say what is and what isn't ours. In these years that I've been in the industry, or all my friends have, I think there's already been a massive change. You can't simplify what it means to be Chinese or look at it from a hampered point of view, but what Chinese designers can offer in the global industry level. This is something I've seen as a designer in this generation.
China is no stranger to large-scale production, so I was curious how they and their clients see the issue of ethical production, which China has long come under scrutiny for. I asked Ming Liu, the founder of Miss Min, and Ian Hilton if they think manufacturing in China can also be sustainable.
It's interesting because I've been thinking about this eco-friendly thing a lot, especially I'm starting a new collection. I just feel for designers, it's very, very important to really think about what we offer and what we create. It's for what purpose? Does it have a meaning to exist? It's not just about using recycled material. I think it's also for a designer to create something good and last. That's already a huge thing. So we don't produce stuff just to fill a void.
I think that's super key what Min just said, because this is something that's been always very, very important to her. What she's proposing to her client is something that she knows that she needs or wants. It's not about an ego project. It's about creating value.
Not an ego project. Should be an eco project.
It should be an eco project. I gotta write that down. That's really good.
I'm just thinking every decision leads to a result. So every decision is very, very important. And I just feel everyone need to stay focused and just more awareness. Like if we're more aware of every single thought, every action, then that will avoid a lot of waste.
Fega Wang is also conscious of her social responsibility as a fashion designer, and thinks choosing the natural material and ethical workshops to partner with is important to her clients. She also notices her clients in China are more aware of the true value of ethical products.
Well, we can use types of natural fibers and a coloring process that is better for the skin and the body. If you tell them about it, then they'll care, because I think Chinese customers aren't too conscious about it. But when you tell them about it, tell them the story, because it's different to the old mindset, where you simply took money to buy things when you could. I think this is changing now because the time it takes them to want to buy something is lengthening, and they're conscious of brand stories and the designer's creative process. People aren't as rushed now. I have customers that ask me about the product and its construction, and it's clear they care more about it. You can sense it.
Both Ming Liu and Vega Wang were educated in London and decided to make their mark in China by bringing their craft back home. So what was it about Xiamen that appealed to both as fashion entrepreneurs?
I just feel clarity, awareness, a peaceful and quiet mind is very, very important. That's connected to everything we do in life and work.
Because the serenity of this city offers, that pretty much gives you more peaceful state of mind to really think through every single step or decision that you make.
Yeah, Kirk and I were talking earlier about the fact that living in Xiamen wasn't about, you know, it being the Antwerp of China or all of these things that has been called for us. It was a lifestyle decision we made 12 years ago. We happened to meet here. Min was working in Xiamen, and we just fell in love with the city. It was not an easy place to set up a new business. In Shanghai or Beijing or even Hong Kong, one of the fashion capitals, would have been much easier as far as hiring staff. It had its difficulties. It wasn't just an easy choice, but it was definitely a lifestyle choice.
I
think that when I was in Beijing, as I was there for 7 years, there was more media, more going on, which was really good. But I think that this is a calmer environment we can settle in. We can make better quality products because there's no point in making bad quality ones. After 7 years in Beijing, I'm moving to Xiamen in the south. We can move more slowly. There's more of a mentality of longevity here. We don't need to count our months or years as much. When it's done, it's done. We can move more surely, step by step, as we need to.
Maybe the pendulum is swinging and it's Xiamen's turn in the spotlight, but the country of 1.4 billion won't be rid of fast fashion at least for a while. All of them agree that fast fashion will not go away and somehow is essential for keeping up with the surging appetite for clothes in this fast country. But the more important question to ask is whether the fast fashion providers will change for the better. On the other hand, it'll take time for the world to realize the quality of Chinese design is often on a par with internationally renowned labels. Real change is always slow and grueling, but designers like Ming Niu and Vega Wang and a legion of young hopefuls seem to have fallen in love with the process. For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Kurt Lin.
Thanks to Monocle's Kurt Lin, reporting from the city of Xiamen in China. On last week's show, we spoke to the director of the London Design Biennale, the second edition. And now the Biennale has kicked off here in the capital at Somerset House, and it runs until the 23rd of September. Featuring 40 countries, cities and territories from all over the world, the theme this year is emotional states and the importance of putting emotion back into design. We've already taken a tour ourselves with the Biennale's director, Christopher Turner. Here are some of our favourite picks. Lebanon's The Silent Room is about a universal space where you can isolate yourself from the city's noise. It shows how silence is fast becoming a luxury. Austria looks at climate change's effects on both humans and cities. It's an interactive walk through a dystopian Austrian future. Taiwan's Invisible Calls is about people that are excluded, people's stories we don't tell, and bringing them back into the narrative. And Norway's Learning and Play for All narrows in on the human experience with regard to education and the Norwegian government's inclusive design initiative. Don't miss next week's show, where we bring you our interviews with the curators. The Monocle on Design mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions, so do get in touch by emailing our producer, Daphne Karnazes. She's on dk@monocle.com. This is Monocle on Design. Stay tuned. In 2011, Moscow-based graphic designer Alexandra Sankova decided it was time to create a dedicated space to house the unique collection of forgotten Soviet-designed items, from children's toys, homewares and fashion, to posters, electronics and space race ephemera. So, along with a team of art historians, designers, journalists, curators and architects, Sankova founded the Moscow Design Museum that year, and this year released the book, Designed in the USSR, to shed light on the underestimated and often anonymous designers that worked for Russia's planned economy. Our producer, Daphne Karnazes, spoke to Alexandra Sankova recently and began by asking her how she went about creating the Moscow Design Museum.
When I started a museum with my colleagues, it was absolutely no hope that someone else will do that, because we were studying design and architecture, art history in the universities in Moscow, and we were waiting when such an institution will appear. But years were passing and there was no place to go to see development of design or collection of design. But we were currently traveling and were very inspired by European design museums and have seen that in some countries, there are not only design museums, but also departments of design in the museums. So we thought we will be not waiting anymore, and we will start museum ourselves. And being creative, having creative professions, we thought we should do it in a way that we can make it, as we didn't have any backups like state money or sponsors at that moment. We jumped into the big exhibition of Soviet design in the central exhibition Manege. It was very unexpected because we were invited there 3 months before the opening, and we had to make it like in an incredible rush and stress, but we succeeded. And an exhibition on Soviet design, which particularly is our first exhibition, was visited by more than 150,000 visitors. It was a huge success, absolutely unexpected. While we were preparing this exhibition, we were interviewing Soviet designers. In 3 months, our collection was incredibly enlarged, and people started to donate things to us. Designers were starting to bring their archives, and they were saying, like, Sasha, why didn't you start design collection before? We were putting on fire our archives at the country houses because we were keeping them for 50, 40 years, and nobody never needed them. We were hopeless. So they had regrets that they did it, but still now we are running for the past 6 years trying to collect whatever remained. There's so many things were thrown away.
And you also feature quite a few everyday and I guess seemingly mundane objects as well. What can those sort of objects tell us about the period of time and life in the USSR for people, you know, people's everyday lives?
With industrial design, the situation was much worse. We had the Institute of Technical Aesthetics, and they were the main organization to take care of industrial design. All design was systemized, as we were in the Soviet Union living in the planned economy. That was the main difference between free economy, like it was in Europe or in the United States, or with the Soviet economy. And the ministry, every ministry had their own organization that was responsible for design. So there were institutes of design or special construction bureaus. And after these projects were done in the bureau, they had to go through the artistic committee, which normally was gathering the best designers and artists of this time. So the projects were quite good when they were at the artistic committee. But then when it was coming to the production, there were always a lot of difficulties. And there were no materials that was needed. There were no colors that was initially planned by the designer. So everything was having like some changes. Every project was having changes. And at the end, when they were produced, they normally didn't look like an initial design project. Some designers were saying that we would rather not say that we designed these things, as we don't have nothing to do with the final thing. But the everyday products, they were very, I can say, rough, and they were in this way honest, because this was, they were very functional, and ergonomics was at the high level in the Soviet Union, the ergonomic departments of the design institutions. A very good example of the typical Soviet design's furniture. We had an Institute of Furniture that was responsible for the all furniture industry in the Soviet Union. And the first issue for the institute was standardization and unification. So everything had to be simplified as much as possible. And we didn't have like different types of divanos, of the sofas, of the tables. They all looked very practical, very minimal. And that's what really bothered everyone at the end, because everyone had the same objects at their homes and their houses. And in the 90s, when Soviet Union collapsed, everyone was trying to get rid of these pieces of furniture, as everyone wanted to have something unique and special. Now it's so hard to get those.
And how would you describe the, I guess, unifying aesthetic of these products, for example, the furniture? Were there specific materials that were always used or shapes?
I can say that some qualities that I can feature of Soviet design. First of all, it was sustainable, as you cannot use a product and then next year get a new piece of furniture or clothing. Those things should be very well done with the high quality in order to be used for many years. There are also objects, many objects were multifunctional, like to have an armchair that is going to turn into the bed, or a vacuum cleaner, which you can also color ceiling, or you can have a bed that is growing together with the child, which is now, it's not so popular anymore. As well as they were using a lot of leftovers. When furniture was done, there will be some parts in between that will be left from the major forms, and this will be used for the furniture for children, for example, or the same with the clothing. After the clothes will be, the shape will be cut. These pieces, which will be left in between technical drawings that were cut, then these pieces will be done like a small underwear for children or some napkins. So this will be every piece of material was used. And of course, all Soviet design was anonymous, as Soviet designers worked for the factories and they were working for construction bureaus and institutes.
Am I right in thinking that the word design and designer were banned until the 80s? And is that part of the fact that these people were anonymous and the state wanted them to stay anonymous?
Design was called technical aesthetics, and designers were called artistic engineers. Officially, this word was used in the Soviet Union when Soviet Union of Designers was established. We just called it differently. They were anonymous because all products were coming out with the names of organizations, Bureau Number 5 or Institute of Furniture. And some designers, we can find their names on the projects if we have an archive and some documentation from the project. But some objects that we use every day, and everyone still have them in country houses and in homes, that we all know, like Soviet designed pieces, everyday pieces, but still we don't know who designed them.
What would you say happened to this, you know, industrial design of the former USSR after the collapse of the Soviet Union? And, you know, how has it evolved post-1990s, I guess?
So at the end, when we started our design education and the design system was formed in 1960s, then Soviet designers started to produce their own design projects. The highest point of development of Soviet design was middle of 60s till end of 70s. Of course, those things that were produced at this time, they are, till now, we use them and you can find them around. But in 90s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, also it turned to collapse of the design system. All institutes and bureaus were closed or privatized. But design objects on some factories until now are produced with the same shapes or with the same technologies. And some designs are remaining till nowadays.
Why do you think that it's, with the book now, important to revisit this design? And what do you think that modern designers can learn from these objects and, as you said, the longevity and their simplicity?
I think this will give a lot of ideas. A new look at the history of the Soviet design, which was absolutely underdiscovered and underestimated. And I think that it's always important to look at the history. Like if we look on British or on Danish, all Scandinavian design, that you can, looking in your past, you always can be inspired and you always can bring up new images or new objects that will be having this new technology and historical roots that will be actual and will be reviewed and actualized in the contemporary world. But it's normally very hardly done in Russia. And also now this revival of Soviet design this year, this revival of Soviet design, it looks like it was a revival of avant-garde in constructivism in the 60s. Soviet design was underestimated and was absolutely not interesting, so no one was looking into this history of Soviet design. And this is the process which is going up now, that we are researching Soviet design and giving it a new value. That what happened previously in the 60s, when Institute of Technical Aesthetics and art historians were looking into the past, the avant-garde and constructivism that was forgotten. So now it's a way of like bringing this history and evaluating this history.
That was the director of the Moscow Design Museum, Alexandra Sankova, talking to our own Daphne Karnazes. Alexandra is also author of the book Designed in the USSR, published now by Fiden. And finally today, furniture collectors take note. Brazilian pieces made during the 1950s and 60s are becoming a new must-have on the international design stage, with pieces strongly tied to rare natural materials like Brazilian rosewood. Monocle's Latin America Affairs correspondent Lucinda Elliott takes us on a tour of one of the latest destination design shops in Sao Paulo, Apartamento 61, or Apartment 61 to me, to find out where buyers and collectors are flocking.
Tucked away along a tree-lined street in São Paulo's upmarket neighbourhood of Jardins is Brazil's latest destination design shop. Apartamento 61 is a single-storey modernist home built in the 1940s, that's been entirely restored to showcase a top collection of modernist furniture in its original setting. But this is no show home. Furniture-obsessed couple Andre and Vivian actually live here. Their four pet bunny rabbits are sitting under emblematic chairs and tables manufactured in Brazil during the 1950s and 60s. Balthazar, the youngest of the four, ventures out into the landscape garden that feels like an extension of the spacious living room. The unique style of mid-century modern design that Brazil is known for, with its clear lines and use of richly coloured, heavily grained woods, has become hugely popular in recent years. Back in 2015, the couple noticed an influx of galleries from Europe and the US coming to São Paulo on the hunt for important works. With fluent English and being generally more tech-savvy, they were able to deal better with international business demands over WhatsApp than the city's older, more traditional collectors. Half of their sales today are to foreign buyers, becoming a conduit for galleries seeking new connections. Walking through the curved, whitewashed entrance, shoppers arrive to a light-filled space. Vivian, a former journalist, is outside in the garden enjoying the winter sun on a coral-coloured chair designed by Lina Bobardi, surrounded by tropical plants. Italian-born Bobardi, she explains, with an encyclopaediac knowledge of Brazilian design, was more famous as an architect, in charge of planning one of the country's most iconic museums, the MASP, or Museum of Modern Art, in 1968. As a result, her furniture pieces are very rare. This type of furniture, that was mainly designed by European émigrés using indigenous materials native to the country, had long fallen out of fashion. As recently as the late 1990s, it was not deemed worth collecting, despite using extremely scarce materials of exceptional quality, like the now endangered Brazilian rosewood, or jacaranda. Some of the pieces on display, that go for upwards of thousands of pounds, were found abandoned in attics and storage facilities across the city, waiting to be uncovered. It was the Milan Salone de Mobile exhibition 2 years ago that really lifted the international status of Brazilian modernism, with a huge exhibition of pieces that Apartamento 61 helped ship across the Atlantic. Locals soon took notice. Andre tells me many Brazilian financial types come by the shop that's open for anyone to visit 5 days a week. Such interest, he explains, shows just how valuable Brazilian design has become as a collectible commodity. Modern designers are taking inspiration from the mid-century style and are finding their way into new collections. Bianca Barbato specialises in smaller items made from brass, such as lamps and light fittings. In the study at Apartamento 61, where André attends to client requests, a Ricardo Graham-designed Urbanista three-legged chair sits among its older inspirations. Next month, London will put on a special display of Brazilian chairs, titled Brazilian Ways of Sitting, sponsored by the Brazilian Embassy. An entire floor earlier this year at the International São Paulo Art Fair was dedicated specifically to design, with booths carefully curated, with furniture, glass and tableware. The design industry is not without hurdles. There's still a huge stigma of corruption, bureaucracy and heavy tax burdens when it comes to Brazil as a market more generally. Many of those who have tried to export artwork or design pieces over the years have struggled, occasionally shipping a sofa or armchair as a personal moving house item to avoid crippling tariffs. Designers and sellers hope the new status of Brazilian modernism abroad will help ease these difficulties. Apartamento 61, that was issued its own export license recently, features furniture from more internationally known names, such as Sergio Rodriguez. Rodriguez was one of the pioneers of the country's modernism movement, bringing Brazilian identity to his projects. This moment in design coincided with a broader project to establish a national identity. Antonio Carlos Jobim had just recorded the famous bossa nova track, Girl from Ipanema, written by Vinicius de Moraes in 1962. Architect Oscar Niemeyer finished building the first modernist city, Brasilia, that became the capital and celebrates his 58th birthday this year. Much of Rodriguez's furniture was used to fill the vast, clean spaces of Oscar's designs. Brasilia was even chosen as a UNESCO World Heritage Site for its modernist architecture and unique urban planning. A sale of a solid jacaranda table by Rodriguez is currently under negotiation at Apartamento 61. Sounds of soft Brazilian samba echo from a speaker in the entrance hall. Customers look set to be seduced by her soft furnishings. For Monocle, in São Paulo, I'm Lucinda Elliott.
Thanks to Monocle's Lucinda Elliott in São Paulo there. And that's all for today's programme. Monocle on Design was edited by Christy Evans and produced by Daphne Karnazes. I'm Tom Edwards. Josh Fennett, your regular host, will be back next week. But for now, goodbye and thanks for listening.